Hi, everyone. Hope you're having a great week so far. I'm Tony Chen, and this is Fish and Bits, a business and data podcast on the world of seafood. Today, I had the chance to sit down with the CEO of Aker BioMarine, Mats Johansen, who leads a truly captivating and unique company. From their website, the company is self-described as a biotech innovator and Antarctic krill harvest company, but that doesn't quite do them justice for everything that they do. Yes, they harvest krill, but they also expand that across numerous supply chains, supporting aquaculture products, pet products, and human health products. Additionally, the company is at the forefront of biotech research, high-tech fisheries management, and they even just launched a new algae oil product. The company does all of this, and last but not least, they also have to answer to public markets as a publicly traded company. This last month, they just won the Norwegian Export Award for 2024 and recognized as the country's top company for creating value in foreign markets. And Mats sits at the helm of managing this entire organization. As a leader, you could say he isn't your typical executive. At one point, his goal in life was to skateboard as much as possible. And now he's steering a company that navigates challenges across so many different sectors and global issues. In this conversation, I had the chance to chat with him about his career, how he built culture, the business of Aker BioMarine, and the management of the Antarctic krill fishery. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode, so let's dive in. Mats, thank you for joining the Fish and Bits podcast. Really excited for the conversation today.
Thanks. Great being here.
Yeah, it's just to start off, I mean, I'm curious to hear a lot about kind of your career pathway and how you ended up at Aker. We'll definitely dive into the business, but to start off, I'm really curious just to hear your story on how you moved from marketing into becoming a CEO and running one of the largest, I don't know if you consider yourselves a fisheries company, a biotech company, it's a little bit of everything, but yeah, would love to hear the story.
Yeah, and I think probably have to start all the way back, right? I started as a high school dropout. I grew up in a small town by the coast, was an active skateboarder in my youth, came into Oslo to start studying, met a lot of skateboarders in here, started studying finance. After 6 months, much more tempting to go skate with the other guys. So I did that for 3 years. So whenever all my buddies were going to university, I was out traveling broke, but had a lot of fun, and learned a lot. And later I kind of with that experience, something that I brought with me in business, right? Skateboarding, it's all about balancing risks. It's about, your equity is your body, so if you take too much risk, you hurt yourself or, even die. So you need to but you need to take risk to make progress, to learn something new. But eventually after 3 years, I was so broke, had to find a job, worked myself up, started working eventually for a telco company here in Oslo. We did very well. There's a newcomer came in, took a big market share. I went to some telco conferences, spoke about that success, got picked up by the state-owned telco monopoly in Czech Republic. They were going to privatize, needed some international people that can kind of talk to the potential buyers, in the leadership group. So I joined them. We're 5 years in Czech Republic, and then we were in 2009. Was time to go back to Norway. Telco was kind of over. I mean, the fun days of telco was over, and I really wanted to come and work for Aker. The group, the ownership of Aker BioMarine, the owner there, Kjell Inge Røkke. A lot of people know him. He's very similar to me. He doesn't have a formal background, no education himself. He doesn't care about that. He looks at the person, what you do, what can you deliver. Perfect fit for me. And then Aker BioMarine was just starting up. I made a big jump over here. We were 3 employees, 0 revenue. And now we're 700 employees and $340 million of revenue. So yeah, that's how that happened.
That's a heck of a story. I mean, I have to ask, do you still skate at all? And do you still consider that part of your life and kind of hobbies and whatnot?
Yeah, I still do. And I think it's an important part of my identity. Still do.
That's fantastic. Then I have to ask the follow-on question, I guess, of are you a snowboarder then as well when it comes to the snow side, I would assume?
Yeah, but I mean, mainly a skateboarder, but all skateboarders, they snowboard in the winter because there's difficult, especially in Norway, to do skating in the winter. But yeah, some snowboarding as well.
That's very, very, that's, I had no idea. That's just the first time that I've heard of that. I mean, I can only imagine how many different, I guess, career paths, how it's impacted your career moving forward. I mean, as a personal question, I'm curious, you know, now you run a publicly traded company. You're constantly, you know, having to do webinars and webcasts, quarterly financials. How have you grown into that position, so to speak, or what have you learned along the way? I mean, I'm assuming, I don't know if you still get nervous to make those presentations, for example, but especially somebody that didn't necessarily have a career in finance or is a trained executive, so to speak. How has that process been over the last decade or so?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm still nervous, right? And when you stop being nervous, you stop preparing and then you do bad performance. So I think that's you should be nervous. And it's kind of like, what do you call it? You know, in front of these type of, you know, big quarterly presentation, part of me kind of is excited, looking forward to presenting it. Part of me kind of feels uncomfortable. You know, it's a lot of eyes on you. You need to do it perfectly and all that. So that's, you know, you need to live with that, need to kind of learn how to handle it and make sure that doesn't draw your energy. And I think I'm quite good at that, so I can kind of, you know, go in, do it, and not waste energy the week before, but kind of do it and actually come out of that with a lot of energy to you know, bring back into the business. So yeah, I think for everybody out there, I'm sure I talked a lot about people about that. I'm open about you know, being nervous about it. I think a lot of people are, but no one dares to say. But I can assure everybody that have that feeling. That's totally normal. Everybody has that feeling, and no one on the other side notice that you are nervous. It's just you. So yeah.
Does it change if you know a quarter? I mean, I'm assuming it changes, but do you prepare differently if it's, you know, a down quarter compared to, I think everything's exciting, business as well, everything is perfect, those are a little bit easier, but. Do you think differently kind of going into what the results look like?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's easier when you have good news to share, but I prepare the same way. You know, go through what I'm going to say, trying to find, you know, when you have a presentation like that, you can fumble a little bit to try to find the right words, right? So I try to go through it a couple of times before. So I find the right words, how to position it. And especially when you're a stock listed company, you need to weigh your words carefully, right? Because people put a lot of things into what you say. So if you're too optimistic or too pessimistic, you know, it might impact people's decision around the share. So yeah, so I take that serious, you know, that part of the job.
No, absolutely. And I'm curious to hear, kind of just listening about your background and how you've transitioned from different careers, skateboarding, Telefonica and communications, and now kind of more into the ocean and human health side. You know, what drives you? What kind of impact? I'm assuming it sounds like there's been different shifts throughout your career. First, it was just finding a job. First, it was just being able to pay the bills. And kind of how has that evolved? And what are you thinking about now from your career point of view, as far as looking to the future?
Yeah, and you're right, right? It evolved, right? So in the early years, my first jobs in the telco business, when I moved to Czech Republic, it was all about getting the maximum out of my opportunity, right? You get an opportunity, just make sure I maximize that opportunity. You know, give everything I have, right? When you first get that opportunity, make sure you grab it. So, and that's what's kind of taking me further. But now it's a little bit different, right? Now what I'm really excited about is to, even if I don't own the company, you know, it's my company. It's my culture. I can build a culture I believe in. I can have the type of way of working, the way of strategy that I believe in. And that is extremely fulfilling. I'm sure you feel the same a little bit with your business, right? That it's yours, and you don't need to have a boss that wants to do something else like you. It's actually your business. So I really enjoy that, and that's something that kind of makes me so kind of, what to say, happy or engaged into this business, because I really feel it's kind of something I have created together with all the colleagues here, but kind of special feeling.
Absolutely. It's that resonates a lot. I mean, that's part of the reason that we started a business was that we felt like we could have more control over it. We could develop the culture. It gets you up in the morning. There's so many different things to think about. One of the questions that I had kind of as building a culture, building your business, you know, thinking about the team is I think I saw in your profile that as a leader, you consider yourself an optimistic leader and believing in saying the power of saying the power of saying yes. I'm curious if you could explain a little bit more about that, because it's in your perspective, I assume the kind of skateboarding lifestyle, everything you've learned influences it. But I think that's a unique trait in how you position yourself, especially I feel like the general consensus when you look at publicly traded companies is stone cold CEOs, ruthless kind of sharks is what the world sees when you talk about publicly traded companies and executives, suit and tie, all of that. Curious to talk about kind of how you feel what an optimistic leader should be and how that's different.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's my favorite topic. So I'm glad you brought that up. But and it's all about taking risks. And you know, Steve Jobs, he has a famous quote, which is, you know, innovation is about saying no to 10,000 things. You know, it's a famous Steve Job quote, and I totally disagree with what he's saying. Right? I think he said that because it was his company; he had ideas, and he didn't want anyone else to have any other ideas. Just do what he wanted them to do. Right? But I have studied this. I mean, it comes from skateboarding, right? The only way to make progress is to take risks. You have to try something you haven't tried before. That's how you evolve and become a better skateboarder. And I believe it's very similar in business as in life in general. And the fact is that it's human nature not to take risk. And there's tons of studies, even where they study kind of social science on how people kind of behave, is that it's natural to not take risks. And it comes probably from when we were cavemen, right? We're living in caves. If we were able to get, you know, some extra food, the value of that was limited because we couldn't store it. But if you lost the food for a day, you could die. So therefore, we as humans, we actually put twice the value on the downside as the same amount on the upside, if you know what I mean. So that means that for an organization like my organization here, everybody is by nature set up to say no. So if we as corporation, as managers and leaders build on that, nothing is going to happen. So we have to turn that around. We have to help the organization kind of take those risks because it's natural for them not to do it. So that's why I'm so vocal about that. And I believe that leaders, they need to help the organization to say yes. Build that culture, that environment where, yeah, why not? Let's try it. There's a flip side to it, right? Which a lot of corporations don't like. One thing is that it creates chaos, because when you say yes to a lot of things, you have a lot of things going on at the same time. So you need to manage that. But at the same time, you have a lot of things going on at the same time, and you can move them in different pace depending on how opportunities develop and how external factors develop. So that is one part. And then also generally in most corporations, it's not good for your career to make mistakes, right? I mean, it could be devastating for your career actually to do a mistake. So generally, it's better not to try it. You know, it's safe. No one will punish you for saying no, but you might get punished for saying yes and fail. So that's what I'm trying to kind of reverse here and make it almost like a symbol. You know, kind of course, we don't say yes to everything, but it's kind of that should be our general attitude, you know, that we should kind of try things out.
Is there anything tangible kind of as far as what you've put in place to encourage that? Because, I mean, from my perspective, I worked for the U.S. government previously, and you could see it. Any sort of room, any sort of new innovation, new idea, when you're in a room with 20 people making a decision and you have two people that say no, that mentality, that attitude can shoot down entire decisions. It's as simple as that. I mean, is there anything tangible, something process-oriented or whatever you've put in place? Culture is obviously a big part of it, but anything that helps you in that meeting room, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's our culture. I mean, we have, we have kind of what you call it, institutionalized our culture. You know, I try to describe it, what it is, and so we use it when we hire people, and it's on the walls everywhere. And we one of those kind of sentences or values or whatever you call it in our culture is can do and grind through. You know, so that's kind of the basis of our culture, how we do business, which means, you know, we believe we can do it. You know, we're optimists, but at the same time, we acknowledge that we're going to hit the wall at one point, right? And we just have to grind through that wall. So I think it's nothing more than that. I mean, you see that on the wall, everybody, everywhere. I practice it. You know, when people come to me with ideas, I very often say yes, which means I get a lot of great ideas coming my direction. And of course, it's very tempting to do lessons learned, for instance, when you fail, right? And I'm sure everybody that listens to this and are part of these lessons learned, very often when you ask for these lessons learned, it's not actually because you want to learn, it's because you want those that fail to have some pain. So I'm a little careful with those things, right? Try to focus lessons learned on the wins instead, right? And not so much on trying to learn from those mistakes, because generally people feel that very uncomfortable. It's going to make them not want to take that risk again because it wasn't so fun to sit in those meetings. And also generally people are not so good at kind of looking into themselves when they did something wrong. They typically look on the outside. But if you're looking at a win instead, then people actually look at their own behavior. And what did I do right here? What was good on this side? And what can I learn? What's the lesson learned from this win? So it's more about that day-to-day behavior, how I have recruited the management team here that have a similar type of mentality. So it kind of goes in the hallways.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And there's so many avenues to dive into with how you build a team and how do you establish a culture. I mean, I've read some books. I've heard about how other people have done it. I have come to learn, I don't know, my opinion is that there really isn't a process. There isn't a silver bullet. It does come from the top down, and it's not something that's necessarily tangible. It's something that you set with experience, you set with leadership, and it needs to funnel down from there. You can't really force it, but
it's quite interesting, right? When we started on our project, right? I'm sure you're in that stage now, right? In the beginning, the culture is just the sum of the key employees and how their behavior and what sits in the wall, right? But as you grow, we try to write it down and define it. And then we looked at other companies and come out, okay, what do other people do when they institutionalize their culture, right? It's the values, you know, and typical is three key words. And the interesting part is that three words, I think it's integrity, teamwork. Yeah, I don't remember what the third one is, but 50% of the top 500 companies in the world have those same three values. You know, it's not the culture, right? It's nothing that defines you. Everybody else is the same. So the culture is about finding what makes us special, you know, that sets us apart from everybody and create that tribe where it's us kind of against the world.
It's great. It's very insightful, and I think very true. I think a lot of people have the feeling when you look at, you know, the values and keywords of a business, they're all the same. They're all saying the same thing, and companies can spend hours and days thinking about what is the right words to use, and we settle on the same ones pretty much. So culture is really a lot more than that. To do a little bit of a shift, I mean, I would love to. Now that we understand how you came into your career and what drives you and what is valuable about your team and culture, I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the business. It's my understanding is, you know, krill harvesting is obviously the core foundational piece, but the business is so large, so many different products, so much going on. I'd love to hear it from your words as to, you know, how you describe the business.
Yeah, so it started with an idea, right? That you have krill is the biggest biomass on the planet. Nothing there's more of. Twice the size of the human biomass. Untapped before we started. You know, a little bit, but no one had to really commercialize, industrialize that. Then it's krill in all the oceans. You know, and oceans cover 70% of the planet's surface. So it's basically krill everywhere. But it's only in Antarctica they come together in concentration so you can catch it in a kind of commercial way. But it's krill everywhere. And then krill sits in the bottom of the food chain. And, you know, we learn in the biology at school that all the important nutrients and molecules, you know, they accumulate up through that food chain. So our thinking was that, okay, here's the biggest biomass on the planet. It's everywhere, sits on the bottom of the food chain. Through millions of years of evolution, krill and the nutrients in krill must have become important for all life on the planet because of that. So that's our kind of starting point. Here's a large untapped resource and probably has things in it that's going to be important for life. So then we started, okay, building technology. How can we harvest krill in a sustainable way? And we have put a lot of work into sustainability. We are now rated the most sustainable fishery in the world 7 years in a row. Then we started building technology and processes for how to refine out those molecules that potentially are important for life. And then we did tons of R&D, 200 clinical studies we have done so far, to document what are those benefits for humans, for fish, for animals, on those molecules that we find in krill. And then we commercialize what we have found so far. And we find quite a bit of things, right? For salmon, it's important for growth. Appetite increases. They eat more, grow faster. It's important for immune system, for health, for mortality. It's important for quality. So you get less gaping. Maybe the potential get premium pricing on the product. On pets, we see they get better fur. They have, you know, better attention, no problem with joints. And in humans, a wide range of benefits. And then we just started commercializing along that value chain, where we have a perfect business model, I would say, that where you have the aquaculture market that drives volumes. That gives you scale, because you need scale in these type of operations to get it to be profitable. And I think that's what a lot of the alternative proteins out there are struggling with, right? They're not getting to that scale. And then it's kind of a catch-22, you're not able to get out of it. So we have the aquaculture industry that quite quickly could take large volumes to make sure that we can get scale in our manufacturing. And then we have the human market, and partly also the pet market, where you have a higher willingness to pay. So there we can get our super premium. That's what can help us to become profitable by combining the scale from aquaculture with the kind of margins from the other type of segments. So by kind of putting this together in one company like that, we're actually able now to be probably one of the first new sustainable, you know, raw materials that's been scaled to profitability because of that model. So, and then of course we said yes to a lot of things, right? So we set an ESG target to achieve full circularity on all our primary waste streams. And we have a lot of plastic waste from trawls and ropes and packaging materials, and thought we could find a supplier that can pick up the plastic and give us traceability of where it ended up. It didn't exist. So we created a company that did that. Got McDonald's as a customer. So if you walk into a McDonald's in Europe today, those serving trays at McDonald's, they're made from our old trawls. Now we have 20 customers globally. We have a lot of companies we handle plastic waste from, and now it's a separate business with 10 employees. So the business model has kind of grown through kind of that culture, but in some it has created this kind of company that has taken longer to kind of develop than thought, cost more money than we thought, but now is profitable and scaled.
It's quite an achievement. I mean, I'm sure the optimism in saying yes is a big part of it, but did you see pieces of this business model working elsewhere? Was there inspirations that kind of made this possible? Because I would say, yes, from the outside, the primary business is harvesting krill. It's a fisheries business. It's a raw materials business. But in those industries, you don't see this type of vertically integrated business where you're also communicating and building products all the way to the consumer side. I mean, I think one of the things I've been reading a lot about is when you look at raw materials, how it goes into our cars, how it goes into our phones, the companies that are building the raw materials aren't able to do the consumer side. Do you see that as a trend that's changing? I don't know if you built inspiration. I'd love to hear more about, you know, it's obviously hard. You're managing so many different products. You have multiple customers. You have food. You have customers. You have fish farmers. So many different revenue streams. You know, at what point was there the confidence more than just the optimism and could see that it should work?
Yeah, we believed in it from day one, right? And we believed we were going to be profitable in 3 years, right? And this was going to go very, very fast. And that the adoption rates, because, you know, look at the science, makes perfect sense. All the farmers should use this tomorrow. And then, of course, we learned the hard way that it's not so easy. But I would say it's not like I don't think we find inspiration anywhere on this. We were kind of forced to do it like that. because it was the way we had to do it to make it work, you know, where you are in these multiple segments. And I see, again, a lot on the alternative protein side, for instance, or new raw materials coming up. A lot of these companies, they believe the job is finished when you have produced the raw material, right? Just get the factory, get the production process up and make that work. Then you solve it. I mean, for us, that it's 10%. You know, 90% of the job is after that. Building the markets, getting the science. I mean, you know all about it, Tony, from your business, right? How much time it takes to come of one thing. You have a great model and it's software you built, but actually get that out there and have people start using it. And I think people again and again underestimate how much that requires. And then strategically, we believe there's two good places to be in a value chain. It's the raw material control, right? Where you have primary on the raw material because you're not in squeeze in what's going to happen and people may make decisions on behalf of you. And then it's on the consumer side, because those two decides the destinies of things, right? It's the what the consumer's going to buy, the demand eventually there, and actually the access to the raw material. If you're in the middle in that value chain, you're dependent on someone either sitting on that raw material side or someone sitting on that consumer side. And we want to make sure that we have that entire value chain under control.
That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. I'm curious, could you talk a little bit more? There's so many different areas to dive into. The one part I want to start with right now is I want to hear more about the actual fishery side of it. And when you say kind of both of these sides, one is focusing on consumers and one is having, you know, market dominance or leading positions in the raw material side. To start off, you know, why did we not harvest krill before? Is it boats? Or has it been done in kind of smaller pieces? What was kind of the technology breakthrough or kind of light bulb moment that we can go to Antarctica and this can become a raw material source?
Yeah, so in the 70s and 80s, Soviet Union had 200 fishing boats in Antarctica fishing krill. And what they did is that they canned it. They kind of put it in cans and they serve it to the military as the single source of food. A little bit back to our initial thought, right, that here you have a raw material that has everything you need for life. You have proteins, minerals, fatty acids, you know, all the things that you need. Probably didn't taste so good, but it was healthy, right? So they did that. So, and then, you know, after the Soviet Union collapsed, that disappeared. It wasn't a market. It was profitable, probably more costly than kind of the value of the product. So it disappeared. But I know that all the fishermen, kind of, including our owner, they've been always looking at krill, right? They know about this biggest biomass on the planet. No one's been able to do it. I want to be the one to do it, right? So that was, I think, what triggered Aker to start, right? And Kjellinge Røkke, which is kind of what's been the main kind of force doing it. And I think he had the three things you need to do something like that. I mean, number one, he had fishery experience and passion. He had deep pockets. He's a billionaire. And it was crazy. I mean, crazy enough to start something like that. So that was kind of the starting ground on starting to develop this. And then you had just to figure it out. I mean, turned out krill has some enzymes that starts a decomposition process, like the minute it dies. So it needs to be processed fresh. If not, it will have an impact on the process. Okay, so we have to figure out how can we get the krill alive into the factory. Okay, so we developed something we call eco-harvesting that basically pumps the krill from the end of the trawl into the factory and process it fresh. Okay, then we solve that. Then we want to avoid getting bycatch because krill is the biggest biomass. It's not the problem there, but might be other species in Antarctica, right? So we have to develop devices that will eliminate bycatch, you know, in our nets and the way that we design that. So we have to do that. And then we have to get factories kind of to work. So you just have to kind of learn and develop step by step and improve every year. And I think that's been the history of Aker BioMarine, is that just kind of every year we do a little bit better. the guys on the vessels, they figure out a smarter way to do the trawling or a smarter way to manage the factory, or the marketing guys find out a better value proposition, or R&D a little bit better kind of study that we can do, and just step by step making it better and better and better to that stage now where, you know, 2022, the first year for the company to be in black numbers.
No, congrats. It's a great accomplishment. I'm, as far as kind of one of the pieces of technology I've been reading about is the use of data and kind of autonomous drones. I think as engineers and data people, we love to see technology being used. It's always about how do you apply it. I'm curious if that technology is a competitive edge as far as, you know, the other companies that are fishing there, or is it more kind of just for more efficiency from your side? It's, and a, for the audience, it may be helpful just for you to explain what you're doing with the autonomous drones and being able to kind of target where the volumes are.
Yeah. So we catch 70% of all the krill in the world today. So we are the leader. So this is more, there's two reasons why we have developed this kind of technology, which we'll talk about. One thing is kind of how we can optimize our operation, both from a carbon footprint, kind of CO2 point of view, and the efficiency in the fishery. And then the third part is linked to how we can get to the next level of fishery management or regulation. So basically what we have done is that we have, over the last 5 years, built a machine learning model, or artificial intelligence, I guess you should say these days. A model that has taken all our harvesting data, all our sonar data from 16 years of harvesting. And then we have connected in through Hub Ocean here, which is a NGO we share office with, which are building the ocean database, they call it. They gather all available sources of data from the oceans. And we tap into all those data streams from Antarctica. Satellite pictures, weather, currents, everything. Feed it into the model and predict where is the krill at any given time. Where are the biggest concentrations? Where is it the most of it? And then we have a drone that we have developed also. It's a 6-meter autonomous boat that can go on the basis of the artificial intelligence model and confirm where the krill is, and then fishing boats comes after. So that will significantly make our operation more efficient. It will reduce the time spent with a big fishing boat searching for krill, reducing CO2 footprint, reducing cost, increasing harvest. So that's kind of pure kind of economic operational element to it. But then the other thing is that we have worked hard in with the fishery regulation on something we call feedback management system. And that is the big wet dream for all sustainable fishery management people, because that is about setting quotas real time. So in all fisheries in the world, you set quotas based on historical data. And in some places, you have very updated data. Some places like Antarctica, you don't have that because it's too costly. Every 20 years, you go and measure how much krill there is. So then you use these type of drones, that type of technology in the drone we put in place now, on all the fishing vessels, on all the transport vessels in the area. You collect data into the machine learning model, and then you live and real-time predict the biomass, and then you set the quotas real-time on the basis of that. That is the future of fisheries. And we're in the krill fishery, where you have one player controlling 70% of it, we as an industry, we can actually come in and drive this. So in the, it's called CAMELAR, it's the Antarctic Treaty, the 26 nations that have ownership of Antarctica. That regulatory body, we got them to commit a couple of years ago that we will implement feedback management system in these fisheries. And on the basis of that, we are developing technology for us that will help us operational now, but that will be available for everybody so that we can take that step and actually show all the other fisheries in the world how you build the most robust fishery management system. And one thing is that it will allow you to make sure you don't do anything wrong overfish, but it will probably also allow you to catch more from the oceans. If you have more data, more precise data, you can harvest more, you know, go to the limits where you know it's going to renew itself, and you can actually get more resources out of the ocean and be a big part of the solution of the challenges we face in the world.
No, absolutely. I would love to talk more about that specifically, because I think from we're obviously in the aquaculture industry. We see the farm solution as one of the big pieces to fisheries management, to improving seafood outcomes and supply. But it's you can't ignore the fact that fisheries are going to be part of it and what the future of fisheries can look like. I see your business right in the middle of that. I mean, you're dealing with so much. One is the international policy, the dealing with different countries, managing a wild fishery. Also the side of dealing with multiple, being a publicly traded company on the other hand, where I see a lot of you having to manage, I think from the public perception, a lot of negative tones from different areas. The world's being overfished. You know, public companies are just in it for profits and growth. I'm very curious to hear how you balance all that. And maybe a place to start is, I would love to talk about the international side. Because I think in the Western countries, you know, we see the news about overregulated fishing and unregulated fishing. And that is where so much of the fisheries challenge comes from. You know, I 100% agree with you. Well-managed fisheries have a place in this world and we should be able to harvest more fish. But it seems like one of the big detractors to that is international politics in different countries that aren't abiding by fisheries rules. I'm assuming for krill, part of the challenge is, yes, you can't be in Antarctica. It's very hard to just send boats down there. But I'm curious as how you think about this problem, because to a certain degree, I see you as a politician needing to talk with different countries and manage, you know, this group of 26 nations.
Yeah, and one thing is those nations, but you know, these days, you know, people don't have a lot of time. People read the headlines and you know, not too many people dig deep into the data to really understand what is the real situation. And that is one of the major challenges we have. You know, from a data perspective, we are the most sustainable fishery in the world. But if you were to ask kind of a random person on the street, their first reaction to fishing in Antarctica would be, should not do it. It's not sustainable. And that is something that we are facing every day. You have NGOs, you know, that it's a money-making region for them, right? I mean, in Antarctica, penguins, whales, it's easy to create engagement. And we need to kind of deal with these guys that maybe haven't kind of looked at all the data. You know, they looked at some data and maybe supported a little bit that what they were thinking. But we have learned that over time how to do that. And the simple answer to it is that just kind of welcome them with open arms, right? We are here genuinely to build the most sustainable fishery in the world. So if you are an NGO or a person and you believe things should be done differently, you know, because it's not sustainable, tell us. And we're gladly listen to what you're saying and you know, maybe move forward and do something better and at the same time maybe educate you on what we're actually doing. And a good example of that is that we got attacked by Greenpeace, which is, you know, quite professional, I would say, as an NGO, so, right? When they attack you, it's serious, right?
Absolutely.
And we did exactly that, right? We went into dialogue, right? And not in fight, you know? Like, I think many in the aquaculture industry, when they get attacked like that, they go in direct fight, you know? But rather invite them in, what are you thinking about? What's the problem? And their main focus was that, you know, we should create 30% of the ocean into marine protected areas. And that's not happening in Antarctica, or it is actually, I mean, not as enough as they want. And part of the challenge is that in that Antarctic treaty, right, those 26, 27 nations, they all have veto, right? So if you're gonna ban an area, not only for krill fishing, but for tourists, for future exploration of oil and gas or whatever, there's always going to be one nation that's, I'm not too sure. And then you're not able to do anything. So long story short, we agree with you, Greenpeace. This is something we should have. And since we have this system, which is slow to kind of implement these things, we as an industry will do it voluntarily in the cooperation with you. And we're going to get all the other krill harvesting companies to join in on it. And that's what we did in 2018. And we signed up and we created those marine protected areas, and then everybody been following up since. So as I think it's kind of, you just need to address those challenges kind of head on, and not kind of go into fighting mode, but just kind of understand their point of view and try to find a solution around it.
Where do you see that going, kind of, if we think into the future? Because from the way I see it, it's you're able to do a lot of that because you're harvesting such a small limit. In other fisheries, you know, where you are much closer to that carrying capacity or that kind of balance point, it becomes a much harder conversation to have, right? Some countries, you mentioned you guys own or harvest 70% of it. You know, what happens when other companies want to take more of that? And is there a point in the future, let's say 50, 60 years from now, where it becomes a much harder conversation to have when you are getting closer to that carrying capacity, so to speak? Is that something that you've thought about?
Yeah, but the good news for krill, right, it's the biggest biomass on the planet, so there is a lot of it. And, yeah, you know, the quota is set at 1% of the biomass, you know, which is extremely low compared to some fisheries, all the way up to 40% you can catch of the biomass every year. So it's set very, very conservative, and still we're in that area we catch today, we still have only catching 60%. But then you have other areas which we also can catch 1% of the biomass, but which is totally untouched. So this an industry can multiply many times and still be below that 1%, which is the most conservative quota in any fishery in the world. So there's more than enough room of growth here.
Is there concerns about, I guess, that changing, or I'm curious to hear the pressures from the market side, from what you see from the investor and running a public company. Obviously, people want to see profits. People want to see growth of the business. How do you balance the two? Because what you're talking about, you know, coordinating with nations, coordinating with these large groups, even NGOs, that takes effort. That takes budget. There's a business side to all of that you guys have been, I think, showcasing to the world that you can invest in and should invest in. But I'm curious to hear if there's any sort of pushback and how you manage that more as the publicly traded business side.
Yeah, I think from the public side, I mean, there's not more enough kind of volume growth potential for them to be satisfied. and then the other growth part is around value of the product. Right? I mean, back to what you're doing in your business, you know, We do science on our product and can measure what the effects are, and the customers are still only paying a fraction of what the effects for the product really is. And as they get tools like you have, where they can actually measure the effects of changing from one feed to another feed, you know, from one day to another, then they should be able to value these type of products much better, and we should be able to get a better price than what we currently have. So I think there's two avenues of growth for us in that. When we now talk about aquaculture specifically, one thing is to grow the volume. We have a fourth fishing license currently unutilized, which we're planning to kind of get into to usage in the future. But then it's to work with the farmers, work with getting data, so that actually we can get a bigger part of the value that our product actually brings to the farmers globally.
Wow. I think it's such an interesting industry. I mean, you're in such a cool spot. It's really interesting to hear how much more growth is potential there. And I think you're right. When it comes to the value side, it is something that everyone's trying to prove. If we're talking aquaculture specifically, our perspective has been we're not measuring and we don't know which products work and which ones don't. It's not at the fault of the industry. Seeing what happens under the ocean is hard. We've also only had a certain number of generations to measure these things. We're at the beginning of that science. And I would say the same for you. You're still, you know, at the very beginning of that journey as to what that looks like. As kind of a follow-up and kind of lasting question here, I am curious to hear, you know, what are your immediate focuses as a business in the next 5 years versus, you know, where do you see this business going in the next 20 to 30 years?
Yeah, I think for us, it's about more of the same, right? Saying yes to new things as well. So it's a little bit hard to predict, but we have a very good fundament in what we do in aquaculture, what we do in pet food, what we do in dietary supplements. And we're just going to continue to build on that with more science, more new ideas for how to position the products, outreach to customers, have them help them be successful with the product. So I think we have a good path of growth with kind of the businesses we have, so let's say that's in a 5 to 7 year horizon. But in a longer horizon, I believe that the platform that we have built in Aker BioMarine, right, as one of those few new raw materials that can scale to profitability. We have some experiences and we have some infrastructure and some people that can do a lot of things and have in those new ingredients that we need in the industry. So, you know, could be bacteria-based, fungi-based, algae-based, seaweed-based. We have factories, we have infrastructure, we have customer relationships, people on the ground to actually take on those things and use that platform and become, let's call it, the powerhouse in terms of what, you know, those type of sustainable new ingredients for the industry, both for aquaculture, for pet food, and for human health and nutrition. So in the long run, I think that's the direction we're going. But, you know, when you have a culture of saying yes to things, it's hard to know, right? Because you're not locking in your strategy too long into the future, but actually move as you see the opportunities pop up.
Absolutely. And if there's people, you know, listeners out there who have ideas for you and have new thoughts that maybe you haven't come up with yet, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you or to find more about the company?
Yeah, reach out to me. I'm happy to speak to people with ideas. So if you don't find my contacts on LinkedIn, you'll find me. You can send me a message there. Maybe you'll put it out on this one. You can put my contacts. But happy to talk to anybody that has any ideas.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, Mats, thank you for joining the Fish and Bits podcast. Really enjoyed the conversation today. And yeah, can't thank you enough.
Well, it's been a pleasure.